we can go straight into it.
Okay. My name is John Smith, spelt J-O-H-N-S-M-I-T-H.
Okay. So what's your date of birth?
I was born on the 13th of July, 1952.
And when did you move into the Leytonstone area?
I moved into an Acme house in Leyton in summer 1982.
And do you remember, could you say what address that was?
Yeah, it was 28 Colville Road.
And can you sort of describe the house? I mean, can you remember back when you first viewed the house and what kind of condition it was in?
Yeah, I was very excited to finally be offered like a really good-sized place to live in, which was a four-bedroomed house, which I'd never had the opportunity to have before. An incredibly low rent. I think it was something like £82 a month or £78 a month, I think, when I first moved in. But when I actually looked at the house, I realised why it was so cheap, because it was in a complete and utter state. It had really, really serious dry rot to begin with that sort of hit you as you walked in through the door. And when you sort of walked around in the rooms, it was, on several occasions I put my foot through the floorboards that the dry rot was so bad. But it was a kind of potentially nice house apart from that, and had a leaking roof. And it was interesting as a building which it had obviously been squatted just before I'd moved in, because it was full of the kind of, sort of sleeping bags on the floor and things like that, and kind of the remnants of somebody's very frugal life, shall we say. But the interesting thing about the house was that it had, in the whole house, it had three power points, and there was no hot water. There was gas, although the gas oven was made to run on, it was a really old oven that ran on coal gas, so they kind of, natural gas I think had been around for at least 15 years at that time, so presumably nobody cooked there for 15 years, not using that oven anyway. And it was pretty horrible, actually, as an initial reaction, because there was a lot of kind of rotting rubbish in the place. And remember, there were bins, like bin bags, which actually had mouse traps with dead mice in them that had been thrown into the rubbish bag. So it smelt pretty bad. Fortunately, my girlfriend's father at the time was a builder. And a friend of mine who was going to move into the house with us was an electrician. And I'm sort of don't mind getting my hands dirty doing those sorts of things either. So despite the state of the building, we decided to take it on and spent, I suppose, probably about a month making it habitable before we moved in.
Yeah.
And then it was quite a comfortable house. Apart from the fact that it was always very, very cold, we never ever managed to kind of heat it properly. So we had to sit right near the gas fire to keep warm in the winter. That was the only way.
And what kind of adjustments did you make to the house? Did you knock down any walls or anything?
Not as far as I remember. The only thing, we did knock down one wall because the house didn't have an inside toilet, only had an outside toilet, but the outside toilet was attached to the back of the house. So we made a doorway so you could go out from the downstairs back room into the toilet. So you didn't actually have to go into the garden to get to the toilet anymore. But that was the only real structural change we made to the place, other than I had my studio space upstairs, and I had two rooms for a studio space. And because I was a filmmaker, I made a projection window from one room into the next. So I kind of knocked a hole in the room in between two walls and put a window in, so I could view films in one space without the noise of the projector whirring away.
So basically upstairs was your studio and downstairs was where you lived?
It was a bit more complicated than that, because I think when we first moved in, there was me and my girlfriend and my friend who was an electrician. So my girlfriend and I lived downstairs, and it was sort of through what was originally been like a through living room. We used that as our living space. And then the our friend had a room upstairs. And later on, actually, I sublet another room to somebody else. So I did actually have two friends living upstairs. But there were four, as I say, there were four bedrooms in the house. So two of them were used as my studio spaces. But I always lived in the downstairs part myself.
And when you sort of first came to Leighton, what did you think about the area?
Well, I was absolutely horrified at the thought of going to Leighton because I'd been born in Walthamstow and I'd lived in Waltham Forest until about 1973. And then I actually escaped from Waltham Forest and moved to Hackney, actually literally the next road from where I live now. And had quite a nice flat there for years and years and years, but eventually got evicted from that. And so I sort of signed up with Acme to get an Acme place. And they offered me a place in Colville Road. And actually, initially, wasn't as bad as I first thought, because they gave me the wrong address. And they said it was Colville Road E17, which is Walthamstow, which is where I came from. And I thought, oh, my God, I don't want to go back to Walthamstow. So anyway, but I went to Colville Road E17 and actually couldn't find the house. And I thought, this is a bit strange. So I phoned Acme and they said, oh, sorry, it's not E17, it's E11. So it was at least an improvement, because it wasn't in Walthamstow and it was kind of halfway between Walthamstow and Hackney. But actually, when I went there and saw the street, I thought, what a really lovely little back street, because although it was sort of off of a main road, Grove Green Road, Colville Road is a crescent off of Grove Green Road, which was actually a very, very quiet street and really nice leafy street, big mature plane trees in the street. And visually it was an interesting place, because also the back garden looked out onto the central line, the above ground bit of the central line, and across the central line there was the graveyard, the Langthorne Cemetery, so it was a very kind of open view out the back of the house. So apart from the noise of the trains, which got used to very quickly, it was a very nice place to move to. It felt, funnily enough, it felt really quite hostile when I first moved there, because at the time that I moved there, I think there were only two or three other artists living in the street, and most of the people that lived in the street had lived there for, some of them had lived there for generations, and most of them had lived there for really quite a long time, and it was quite a close-knit sort of East London community. Mm-hmm. And although everybody knew there that the road, that their houses were under threat from the road, we were the kind of first evidence really of the fact that things were physically changing, in that, you know, there were new people moving in who were moving into short life houses. And I remember when I first moved there, the neighbours were really quite suspicious and quite hostile, and they thought we were squatters basically, and they kind of didn't like the idea of squatters moving into their street. And it was very interesting that relationship really changed over the time that I lived there. And by the time after I'd lived there for quite a few years and real squatters started moving in, then those people saw me as being a pillar of the community and the new people were the enemy.
Yeah.
But it was understandable, their hostility, because they just felt as though, you know, things were falling apart around them, really. And
what did you think like the high road? Like, when you moved into that house, you must have had a little roam around the area.
It didn't excite me, I have to say. I found it a very, very dead place, certainly. And when I first moved there, I didn't know anybody else who was there. But I was quite excited by having this house. Anyway, it was great. It was great to have, you know, sort of a very big place for a very cheap rent. So I was very happy to have moved there. But the kind of saving grace really was that it was like a 2-minute walk from Leighton Tube Station, where I could get on the Central Line and get out if I wanted to.
So do you think that's what you kind of did most of the time? Sort of go to the Tube Station, go to your place?
Well, it as it turned out, that wasn't what I ended up doing, because very quickly I started to meet people in the area and make friends with other people in the area and realise that there were sort of, you know, a lot of people that I got on with who were living, if not in the same road, in the next one or a couple of roads down. And I met a lot of people in the Northcote pub in Grove Green Road, which was the closest pub to me, and got very much happier with the fact that I was living there when I discovered that there were, as I say, people that I got on with who were living near me.
So were they sort of people that you knew before as well?
No, not at all, no. And most of the people that I met were, I guess most people I bumped into were people who were artists, and I think very often they knew each other, some of them knew each other before. Mm. But I actually didn't know any of them before at all. So I met Zoe Redman and Steve Lippman, who lived directly opposite me in Colville Road. So I met them sort of in the street and kind of got to know them. But other than that, it was really through sort of, bumping into somebody in the pub who knew somebody else, gradually kind of developing quite a large group of friends.
Because I kind of made the assumption that probably you knew Steve and Zoe anyway because of the filmmakers' awards and probably the film co-op and stuff.
Yeah, well, they weren't involved. They were video makers, you see, and at that time there was an enormous gulf between film and video. They were two entirely different worlds that people inhabited. So you had the filmmakers like me were involved in the London Filmmakers Co-op,
yeah.
and people like Steve and Zoe, who were making video, were involved in London Video Arts, or what later became called London Video Access. And they were completely separate organisations. And at that time, there was a really strong kind of, ideological as well as, physical split between the two media. And, basically film and video makers didn't really like each other very much, really. They didn't have much time for each other.
Is because it becomes more interesting in this present context.
Right, yeah. Well, they were very, very different media. I mean, now things are sort of, obviously we still have celluloid and we still have digital technology, which are different, but there's so much more crossover between the two now. And at that time, they were entirely different things. I mean, I worked with, when I first started making films as a student in 1972, when I got to make my first film, at that time, if you wanted to work on video, A, it had to be black and white. B, the quality of the image was absolutely atrocious, although it's very nice to look at it now and think, what a lovely quality that's got, that kind of hazy, kind of indistinct look. But it wasn't something that was, you sort of aspired to at the time. It was inconvenience. And also, if you were editing video, you were doing it with two reel-to-reel tape recorders and basically you're recording from one tape to the other. And at that time, when I first started making video, it was sort of, you had to time it with a stopwatch, like when you press the buttons, and an edit was accurate for about, if you were really good at it,
yeah.
You could get an edit accurate to about half a second.
Nice.
Whereas, with film, you can get make your edit accurate to one frame, a 24th of a second. You had much better picture quality, you could work with image and sound independently. Film was a kind of completely tactile thing, and although video was much more tactile than it is now, it was sort of, it was very limited in relation to film in terms of what you could do with it. It had the kind of immediacy of you could have one machine, one camera which recorded sound as well as picture, and they would link together, which with film, you had to have a separate camera and tape recorder. But anyway, that's a kind of personal thing for the reason that I always sort of stayed working with film. But I was involved with the London Filmmakers Co-op, and the London Filmmakers Co-op was sort of ideologically and conceptually involved with the kind of material of film, with celluloid, what you could do with celluloid as a physical material. Whereas the video artists didn't have that kind of sensibility. It was a completely different one. And I suppose as artist video developed, there were sort of things that kind of, there were sort of two sort of strands of artists, yeah. really. One was the kind of rough and ready, raw kind of video performance kind of a strand, and then the other strand, which people like Steve Lippman were into, was more to do with kind of the physical, with image manipulation, electronic effects and things like that. I hope Steve wouldn't mind if I said that. I think that's what he's, I think he was one of those people anyway. Yeah. Would do things like, you know, multiple screen things and kind of effects orientated things. But
so, you know, like you're talking about the physicality of film and everything. Did you develop your own film in that house?
I didn't in that house. I mean, I could have done. I mean, I you know, although I was saying I came from that tradition, I wasn't personally somebody who some of my early films I developed and printed myself, but I quite quickly got into the sort of laboratory thing of using a laboratory to get kind of, you know, I was wanting to get sort of images that looked like they were kind of commercially produced, although the what I was doing with them was hopefully subversive of, of commercial filmmaking, but it was important that the images looked like they had the same sort of quality as a conventional film.
Yeah. And just sort of thinking about maybe you roaming around the area, because you did that film, didn't you, of the old hospital? Is it down Langford Road?
The Black Tower, yeah.
Is that black and white? Or?
No, it was colour. But that film very much came out of... yeah, it's good you mentioned that, actually, because the Black Tower completely came out of my experience of first moving to Leytonstone and seeing this building and wondering what it was. And so when I moved into the house, as I said a moment ago, from the back of the house, I could see across the central line and across the St. Patrick's Cemetery, Langthorne Road Cemetery. And the other side of the cemetery, I could see this tower sticking up out of the landscape. At the time, I didn't know it was in the grounds of a hospital. I could just see this brick tower with this sort of black, what looked like a kind of black garden shed on the top of it. Yeah. Enormous, but an enormous structure. And I was sort of fascinated by this building, and I thought it's really kind of... It had a kind of sinister quality to it. I suppose it's a kind of cliche of, you know, it being dark and... And the top part of the tower had this, I think it was like a metal tank, but it was painted with bitumen black paint, so it was completely non-reflective. So it meant that, I think it had just been painted when I moved in there as well, probably, because you couldn't see the joins between, because there was no reflection and it was dark, so you didn't get much shadow. You couldn't see the joins really between the walls and the roof. So when you looked at the top part of the tower, it was like a brick column with this sort of polyhedron sat on top of it. And depending on what angle you were, this polyhedron would change its shape. So, and I was really interested in this sort of non-reflective black shape, because also on a sunny day, it looked like a hole cut out of the sky. It looked like somebody got a Stanley knife and cut a bit, you know, got on the top of this brick column and cut this bit out of the world. And it was like this black void. But so I found it quite sinister and quite sort of very mysterious anyway. And I asked my next door neighbour at the time, who was somebody I didn't know, a week or so after I'd moved in. And at the time that I met him, I didn't realise he was quite an eccentric character. And I said, "What's that?" I said, "Do you know what that building in is?" And he said, "Yeah, it's the psychiatric ward of the hospital." And which was quite interesting, because although I later found out it was just an innocent water tower, the water supply for the hospital, it kind of was interesting that he kind of gave it that kind of sinister reading as well. And anyway, I went on to make a film which was to do with this tower following somebody around. And what I did was I filmed the tower from different angles and... using the voiceover, suggested that it was actually in different places. So if I could see it over some trees, I'd say, "Oh, it was in the country." Or if I could see it behind a high wall, I said, "Oh, it was in the grounds of a prison." So I kind of invented narratives around what the place looked like, although I just photographed it from different angles. And the kind of narrative of the tower following me around came out of the fact that, like with lots of tall buildings, they do pop up unexpectedly if you're in a place that you're not familiar with. So I would kind of walk down one road in Leytonstone. At the end of the road, I could see the tower sitting up, standing. I think, I didn't think it was there. I would have thought it was over there, you know. So, and of course, now we get that with buildings like the Gherkin, or before that, Canary Wharf, you know, where you'd always be seeing. It's very strange that you always see this building because it's a tall building. It's visible from a long distance. So that very much, that film, although I didn't make it until 2 or 3 years after I moved there, it definitely came out of that experience of an unfamiliar place and kind of, you know, first impressions of an unfamiliar place.
I think I saw a really unusual version of that film because it went on Channel 4, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I had a little black and white TV, so I saw it in black and white. Right. And I don't think I had any sound.
Oh, right.
My interpretation of the film was that you traced the building, every angle.
Right. Yeah, no, the soundtrack's very important to it. And there are lots of things to do with colour as well, isn't it? Colour, to different colour fields, or flat fields of colour that turn into representational images. So, you know, you might have a blue surface and then the camera pans across and you realise that you're looking at a sky, or that same blue might have a teacup put down on it and you realise it's a Formica draining board, you know. So it's playing with colour turning abstract images into representational ones anyway.
Because you got loads of awards, didn't you, while you was living at Colville Road? Because I went through the Film and Video Awards and your name just kept coming up.
Oh, grants for funding for films. Yeah. I mean, at that time, I used to, particularly working with film and using laboratories, I was completely dependent on funding to be able to make any work. And I sort of regularly applied for grants. I think I probably, I was there for 12 years, probably got 5 or 6 grants, I should think, over that time. Can't remember now.
Do you think that might have been unusually prolific, or is that the normal pace that you work at?
No, I've never been really prolific. And some of those grants would have been completion grants for the same film as well. When I was living there, I made probably about, in 12 years, made about 6 films, I think.
Can you go for those films?
Yeah. I mean, the first film, I didn't really have any. Most of them, in fact, do really relate to the place, funnily enough. Although I might not have really thought about it that much at the time. But the first film that I made when I was, I started before I moved there, and I finished it shortly after I moved in, and that was a film called Shepherd's Delight, which was a film about, kind of a film about humour, basically, although it was sort of playing on the dark side of humour. It was a film that had come out, a lot of my earlier work had involved humour in some way, and I wanted to make something which sort of tackled humour head on, so I made that film. And that really bore no relationship to place at all. Then I made The Black Tower, which was made between 1985 and 1987. And that was, as I say, kind of came out of that experience, although there were sort of lots of other different elements, and it was very much to do with that particular landscape of Leytonstone, that particular building, and how we can interpret landscape. During the making of that, I made a short film called Om, which is, I won't bother to describe it. It doesn't have any connection to the place. But that was a kind of little, very, very simple short film. But after I made The Black Tower, I made another film called Slow Glass, lots of which was also shot around Leytonstone, very large part of it was shot around Leytonstone. And that came out of the fact that when I've been filming The Black Tower, what I'd done is, because I wanted to film the tower from lots of different angles, and I sort of went around Leytonstone finding all the places where I could see it, and then I just sort of made a list of all the places that I was going to go back to and film the tower in. And so they weren't done spontaneously. It was sort of thinking, okay, I've got that place, that place, that place. I'll wait till the light's good or the weather's right for filming it. And several times I had the experience of going back to film a shot of the tower and something had changed and obscured the view of the tower. And it made me think, God, this is really strange that how quickly the landscape is changing. It doesn't feel like, I mean, it's before they started building the road, so it didn't feel like there was a lot of kind of architectural stuff going on. But because I was sort of, you know, tuned into these very specific kind of views, I realized that things were changing all the time. And they might be little things like, you know, like they changed the street lamp or something. Or I remember there was a kids' playground in Langthorne Road, and I'd planned this shot looking across to see the tower behind the kids' slide, this slide in the playground. And I went back to shoot the shot, and the slide had been taken away, and it was kind of quite disorientating. I thought, that's really weird, because it was this thing which was, you know, cemented into the ground, and I sort of looked down, and all I could see was like a patch of black asphalt where they'd taken it away and redone the surface. And anyway, I started thinking about kind of how everything changes constantly, you know, and things that basically the world's in constant flux, and even the kind of the things which we sort of rely on. And I'm not talking about, you know, Docklands or something. I'm talking about quite a sleepy bit of suburban London. Nevertheless, everything is changing all the time. And at the same time, I got interested in something that I found out about glass. And there's I don't know whether she's somebody that you know of. Debbie Thomas used to live in used to live there, and I she was somebody that I knew, and she was asking people. She was making chandeliers from broken bottles, and she was asking friends to collect their old wine bottles for her. And I remember having a conversation with her, and I'd given her some wine bottles a few weeks beforehand, and I said, "Have you done anything with those bottles yet?" And she said, "No, not yet, because I've broken the glass, but I'm waiting for the edges of the glass to get a bit less sharp before I start working with them." And I said, "What do you mean?" Yeah. And she explained to me that basically, if you cut glass, the freshly cut edge of glass is very sharp, but if you leave it for a little while, it dulls the edge. I mean, it's still sharp, but it's blunter than it had been previously. And I started to think, God, even glass, which is like, I think of this most kind of stable material, is kind of, even that is changing. Everything is changing all the time. So I ended up making this film called Slow Glass, which is about change and about the constancy of change. It's got a lot of kind of philosophical stuff as well involved in it, but it's rooted in the sort of change in the physical world. And then and it's funny, when I look back on it afterwards, I don't think I thought about it at the time, but when I look back on it afterwards, I think, well, actually that probably comes a lot out of my experience of living in a short life house, and that insecurity of the fact of knowing that this house was going to get knocked down, you know. So it's like that whole thing about, you know, sort of the, you can't rely on anything. It's kind of, was probably how I was feeling about the place, because, you know, it's very important to me. The place that I live has always, and having a home has always been really important to me, you know. And so that was quite interesting to sort of, I mean, it might be a complete load of bollocks, you know, but it's like we can always rationalize things in retrospect, but when I sort of think about it now, I think, oh, maybe that was a big part of the, you know, the ideas behind the film. Because I moved into that house in 1982, as I said, and I was told when I moved in, you've got 18 months, maybe 2 years before you have to move out. And because of the campaign against the road and the slowness of the Department of Transport themselves, and then later on different kinds of road protests and things, I ended up living there for, I was thinking it was 13, maybe it was 12, at least 12 years anyway. But for the last 10 years, the whole time it was like, oh, you're probably going to have to get out in 6 months. So you never knew how much longer you had. And consequently, the house that I lived in kind of fell apart more and more and more. I never bothered to actually fix anything because I thought, okay, well, I might have to move in a few months. There's no point.
Because actually, when you think about it, you did actually do a lot of work on the repairs and so forth.
Oh, yeah, to begin with, yeah.
And how long did that take?
About a month or something, I think, yeah.
Because you had three people?
Yeah. And my girlfriend's dad as well helped out and did some plastering for us and things. And But to stick with the work thing, then later on, the last two films that I made, there were Blight, which is specifically relates to the demolition of the houses and the building of the motorway. But that film was very much also to do with the idea of the house and the kind of identity of a house and how I kind of anthropomorphized houses really in the film and sort of saw them as places that they were identities. They had a life and they were being destroyed. And I got very interested in that sort of obscenity of how when a house is knocked down, you start to see the private world of the person who used to inhabit it before. So just looking at the wallpaper and things like that, it feels like kind of very cruel in a way, that kind of exposure of a private world to anybody's view who goes by.
And the soundtrack, the monologue, was that... Sheila Thompson.
Sheila is one of the people on the soundtrack. Yeah, what we did was that. I did a lot of interviews with different people. They weren't all people who lived in the area. Actually, there are about 10 or 12 people on the soundtrack, and I went round and I interviewed people about. And asked them questions, not specifically to do with the M11 or Leytonstone, but I was asking people about what they remembered about places that they'd lived in that they couldn't go back to anymore. So that somebody might have been talking about a childhood home or something. It wasn't necessarily somewhere that had been demolished. But I was interested in those ideas of sort of memory and loss around a place. There were a few people who lived in the area that I interviewed. It was her. There was Dolly Watson, the old lady who lived in Claremont Road. Other people that I knew from the area, but also a few other people that I really wanted to talk to people of different ages, actually. So I had sort of lots of generations of people because I wanted to go back to more or less the time when those houses were built, which was so we're talking about 90 years or so. Dolly Watson, I think, was probably as old as the houses, I think, as far as I remember. And I was interested in these sort of layers of history, and I don't know. There's one part of the film where there's a tree trunk that's been sawn through, and you can see all the rings of the tree, and there are voices of people of different ages, just sort of saying these little fragments. Actually, to do with numbers, they might be saying their house number or their age or something like that. It's sort of vague, but it's giving you an idea of sense of time and history. But what happened with that film was that I recorded these interviews, and then mainly Joss, the composer, Jocelyn Pook, who I made the film with, she actually took fragments from the things that people said and wove them into a kind of musical structure. So they're deliberately kind of quite oblique, a lot of the things that are said. You know, there aren't very many direct references to that place and time until the very end of the film. So I was interested in, as I say, about ideas, more general ideas about memory and the life of a house and a person.
And have you still got those original recordings?
I have got them, actually, yeah. I mean, they're on reel-to-reel tape, but... Funnily enough, somebody asked me for one the other day because it was her mother was one of the people I did a very long interview with, and she died a few years ago, and she really wanted to get a copy of the recording. But I mean, I don't know what a lot of the people would have thought when they saw the film, because I sort of talked to people for about an hour, and then used just like somebody's, you know, I might just use somebody saying blue and a little bit of green or something like that. So they were very much fragmented the voices. So I think I warned them beforehand that there weren't going to be long bits of interview in the film. But
you spoke briefly about that period when you first moved in and you said your neighbours were a bit suspicious and then people started to kind of mingle.
Yeah.
Kind of roughly was that time?
Well, I think it was just to do with getting to know people, really. I mean, I moved in 1982, and in Colville Road there were only... I can't remember whether I've said this on tape or not before. I'll say it again anyway. You can always say the shit. I moved in 1982, and I was one of the first artists to move into my street, and the street was full of people who'd lived there for a long time, and they were sort of a lot of the neighbours were very kind of suspicious about these unknown newcomers moving in, you know, who probably had long hair and stuff, didn't kind of quite fit in with them, and so to begin with, people they weren't overtly hostile, but they were kind of, they weren't friendly at all, and it took a little while to sort of get to know people. And I remember actually it didn't take very long with some people. Like my next door neighbour had, I think, 4 small kids, and it was very hard to keep these kids out of the house. They wanted to come in and help us when we were sort of decorating, you know, building on the house. So it's quite dangerous for them, but they were very eager to kind of come in and sort of help us out, and their parents didn't seem to mind. So we sort of got to know those people quickly.
Because that's one of the things which was quite distinctive as well, was this little gang of children that would roam up and down the street.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
With curiosity, going in and out of people's houses.
Yeah, yeah.
They probably knew more what was going on than
anyone. Yeah, definitely, yeah, yeah. I remember there was one kid who lived in my street. I can't remember what his name was now, but he lived kind of on the other side to the left. And he started off, he was always a little bit dodgy, but he was kind of quite a nice little boy. And then as he kind of grew up, he started to turn into this kind of rather frightening teenager. And then I remember hearing that his brother was inside for murder, who'd killed somebody with a knife or an axe or something, you know. And it was quite strange to see those kids sort of, you know, turn from these sweet little innocent kids into some of them kind of became, you know, kind of... quite proficient tearaways. So those people that you've been letting into your house when they were kind of 5, you didn't, or 6 or whatever, you didn't really want to let them in by the time they were 14.
So do you think, like, somehow the kids were way in to meet the parents and the neighbours? Because did you kind of think that maybe you've met... Yeah, how did you meet local residents?
Yeah, I think it was largely through kids, actually. Because Sheila Thompson lived next door to me, and she had 4 kids, three of whom were quite young. And then she had a friend up the road, I can't remember what her friend's name was, who was what was her name, who had some kids as well, and... So a lot of people on the road got to know that way. I mean, there were lots and lots of people in the road that I never knew, really, that were there for years and years and years that I didn't really, you know, I might nod to them in the street, but there were probably only, of the older residents of the street, there were probably about 6 or 8 families that I knew to sort of say more than hello to. So it was Richard Layton, and there was Sheila's mother, who lived on the other side of the road, who was agoraphobic, who'd never left the street for years and years. And then there was an old man who lived, what's his name, Len, somebody who lived over the road from me, who always used to get me to come and... change his Calagas cylinder and his heater. I think he had arthritis and couldn't change the valve on the Calagas heater, so he'd give us a weekly knock and say, will you come and change the cylinder for me? And that, which was always nice to be able to do for somebody.
Yeah, loads of people seem to have those Calagases, didn't they? Heating
Well, they're efficient ways of heating a an energy efficient house. And well, they give out enormous amounts of water vapour.
Yeah.
They certainly pump the heat out. So.
And Sheila Thompson, who lived next door, did she used to live with Reg Thompson?
Sorry, I'm getting completely muddled up here. I just realised Sheila didn't live next door. Sheila lived up the road. It was another woman. Oh, I can't remember what her name was now. And she was actually a single parent, had four kids. She had this, as I say, this sort of rather strange boyfriend, but he sort of disappeared after a while. Or I think he was just some bloke who used to hang around. And anyway, I hope she doesn't hear this. But she won't, because she's dead. She died, she got lung cancer and died 5 or 6 years after I moved there, I think. And her mother came and moved in, and basically when she died, her mother stayed there with the kids and looked after the kids. So that was quite a big big change that happened over a period of time.
So are we talking about the house next to 32 Culver, right? The derelict one?
Mm-hmm. Number 30.
Yeah, I know the family.
Yeah, I can't remember what her name was. But maybe she died even earlier than that, actually. I think she was only there for like three years maybe before she died. I think they were there with her mother for a long time. But there was an older boy called John and then three girls. I can't remember. John was quite a funny one, because him and his mate Jordan, who I think was one of Sheila Thompson's kids, they used to go fishing. And I had a pond in my back garden, and one day they knocked on the door and said, "We caught some fish from the pond. Do you mind if we put them in from up the road? Can we put them in your pond?" And they gave us this plastic bag with these kind of like insipid looking fish in it. And I thought, "Oh, all right, what are they going to do with it if I say no?" So I said, "Okay, all right." So I put these fish in the pond. And a couple of weeks later, I came home one evening. I came into the house and I looked out the back window, and John and Jordan were standing at their side of the garden fence with fishing rods, fishing in my pond to catch the fish back. So probably catching my goldfish as well. But it was quite a nice image, just seeing these two boys fishing over the fence into a pond.
And also, going back to the artists that you know, can you mm-hmm. talk about them and like maybe what they were doing at the time?
Well, I've already mentioned Steve and Zoe, Steve Lipman, Zoe Redman, who were making video work. I think the next person that I met was Connie Parker. And as far as I remember, I think I bumped into, I met her in the Northcote pub, and she was a very kind of gregarious socialite kind of person. So I actually got to meet a lot of people, you know, through her, in fact. And she was making, I can't remember the earliest things that she was doing. She was making I think it's a little bit later she was doing it, but she was making lead suspended sculptures of monumental buildings hanging from steel wire. So a sort of early version of the things that she done later on in a more economical sort of form. She was making work like that. And then she introduced me to Graham Miller, who was involved with the Impact Theatre group, doing experimental theatre work. Pete Brooks and Jeremy Payton Jones, Pete was also involved in Impact. I think it was at the end, more or less the end of Impact Theatre, but they were still doing things there. Jeremy Payton Jones, composer. And Jocelyn Pook, who's a composer as well, who later on, I collaborated it on Blight. Well, at that time she was mainly playing as a session musician or and playing with bands like ABC and the Communards. She was in those bands and busking and doing all sorts to make a living. Connie was cleaning toilets to make a living. Gary Stevens I met that time as well, yeah, through, largely through Connie, because there was a big house on the corner of Grove Green Road and Cathall Road, which is where Graham and Jeremy lived. Who else did it? I can't remember whether Pete lived there as well, not sure.
Pete Owen?
No, Pete Brooks.
Oh, right.
They were the people that I knew from quite early on, and then later on I'd sort of get to meet other people. I mean, most of those people remained, you know, sort of friends that I still see. Some amongst my closest friends now. Later on, I think a few years later I met Ian Bourne. I remember bumping into him in a, just chatting, having a chat with him in a pub, and then realising that I knew of his work and he knew of my work a bit. And, we discovered we had quite a lot in common in terms of interested in making work which related to East London and had monologues, both monologues and things. So, but then there were a lot of other kind of characters that you sort of vaguely knew. Well, there were the people that were sort of, there were other people who were sort of artists, but you didn't really know what they were up to, really. You know, and there was a bloke called Donald, somebody who lived in, who made these strange kind of fetishistic sculptures. He lived in Grove Green Road. This guy John Pye, who usually ended up going back to his house after the pub, I think. But I mean, I remember some very grim kind of things like New Year's parties and things in Grove Green Road. Like somebody's having a party in Grove Green Road, and you go to this house, and it was like there was no furniture, no heating, and a couple of cans of lager. A lot of people getting very out of it. Somebody sitting in the corner playing bongo drums. So it wasn't all. It was an interesting mix of people there, I think, you know, as well. A lot of it was quite marginal from sort of early on as well. People who were sort of finding it a bit difficult to cope with life and. Largely, a lot of people who were squatting, you know, that were having difficulties of one kind or another, you know, generally.
So when did sort of like the other artists start moving in, when you felt there was like more artists?
Well, I think there was a gradual influx, and some people moved in, and they didn't move into Acme houses and things, I think. But I think probably about 1984 was when there started to be quite a lot of people around. I think that's about the time that, as far as I remember, that Connie moved there and Jocelyn and.
So were those houses like empty before the artists moved in, or?
I don't know. I mean, some were and some weren't, I think. Generally, most of the houses that I saw people move into, they were in a pretty bad state of repair. So, I mean, historically, I think they'd largely been owner-occupied houses that had been, that the owners had been bought out of. Sometimes years and years before they actually became vacant or became let out again. I think a lot of them were empty for a long time. I think the Department of Transport compulsorily purchased the place, and then I think probably before Acme got hold of them, I think a lot of those houses had been boarded up or, you know, and empty for some years. Some squatted, some not. But I found out, it was interesting, after I moved in there, I found out from my parents that somebody that they knew, a distant relative, had lived in Colville Road and her house had been compulsorily purchased, I think, in 1947. Or it was years, it was absolutely years and years and years ago anyway. I mean, because the road was planned from, you know, before the Second World War. There was going to be not a motorway, but a major road there. So the running down of the area actually started sort of years and years before any of us moved there. And it was kind of sad to know that this woman had lived in this house, I think, all her life, had been evicted and then died years and years before the house actually needed to be demolished. You know, she could have lived there quite happily for all of her life. I'm sure that happened to quite a lot of people.
Yeah. Did you find out what number the house
had? No, I didn't. I know it was, it would probably would have been around about number 15 or something. Couldn't find out now. Both my parents are dead, so I would never be able to find that bit of information out. But I've got a feeling that they said it was round about there, sort of other side of the road to me on the left, a little way down.
I mean, when you look back on that time as well, I mean, when I think about those artists that were there sort of before me, which is, you're one of them, they seem to be quite prolific and actually quite successful. Do you think it was quite a positive time for making work?
Definitely. I mean, in more ways than one. I mean, for me, there are sort of two things really that I could immediately identify. One would be the kind of breathing space of actually, you know, having a cheap rent and having a space where you could make work, and so like not having to go worry about going out and doing a full-time job, which I've never done. But also to do with mixing with other people and, you know, meeting other artists and kind of feeding off of each other and having a sense of kind of community. Because until I moved there, I mean, I suppose I left college in 1977, so I was sort of, for 5 years after leaving college, I didn't have much contact with other artists. There were a few filmmakers I'd been at college with that I still had contact with, and we sort of intended to do something together, and we never did. But I was working pretty independently in relative isolation. So it was great to actually all of a sudden be in a group of people where, you know, you had similar ideas, and, you know, kind of very different, lots of people making very different work, but with some people there's, you know, quite a lot of crossover, you know. So, you know, so for me, people like Graham Miller and Gary Stevens and Connie Parker, there were different things which, you know, we certainly could identify within each other's work, I think.
And what about at the time, sort of possibilities for showing work? Like, I noticed you was in the Whitechapel Open one year, wasn't he, as well, and showing a film.
In East London, there weren't that many... Not that many possibilities that I remember and showing work in relation to them, but then my memory is not very good. But yeah, I mean, I showed in the Whitechapel Open a few times, and films in things like the East London Film Centre Festival, which sort of started off actually in Stratford at the Tom Allen Centre, and showing the Black Tower there and things. So it was always nice to actually show work in the area, and I actually did a screening couple of months ago, actually, at the Heathcote Pub in Grove Green Road, that was organised as part of the Leytonstone Festival, and this guy got in touch with me and said, "Will you come and show in the Black Tower and Blight?" So that was great, actually, because it had a really kind of, I think it was a free screening, and it had a really mixed audience, and there were some great people in the audience, and particularly some very old, really quite old people in their 70s and 80s, and this one old lady who was really interested in the formal aspect of my filmmaking, which I thought was great. You know, she said, "You've made me see materials in a completely different way," and I thought it was a great thing for somebody. You don't expect somebody in the 80s to say, you know. And it's like, I don't want to be patronising, but it wasn't what I expected her to say to me anyway. But,
because also at that time, in the early 80s, it was mid to late 80s, it was quite significant in that Channel 4 started to show filmmakers' work, mm-hmm. which was for the first time, really.
Yeah, no, that was a big thing. And certainly for me, it made me feel as though sort of things were opening up a bit more, you know, because I'd always show my work in quite a, you know, sort of very limited sort of context, shall we say, you know, like in London, probably just, you know, the Filmmakers Co-op or very occasionally, you know, the NFT or the Tate Gallery, you know, actually probably not even the Tate Gallery at that time. Yeah, and that did open up. Did open up possibilities.
And then, like, when did you start teaching at East London University?
Well, embarrassing to say, 1978, the year after I left college. So I've worked there for nearly 30 years now. But always on a part-time basis. Never been more than 2 days a week. And now it's just down to one. But.
Break.